Hello, friends of Soul Kitchen. Thank you for listening to my podcast. My name is Jasper Mutsaerts. I'm an entrepreneur, adventurer, coach, and wisdom seeker. With Soul Kitchen, I interview people that inspire me. From TED speakers to social entrepreneurs, from activists to artists, from dreamers to seekers, from business people to spiritual teachers. With Soul Kitchen, I empower people to live their quest. Each episode contains a recipe for life. What is your quest?
Welcome, friends, to a new episode of Soul Kitchen, episode 68. And today I am meeting with someone that you could call a pioneer within the field of psychedelics. I never met this person in person, but I met him online and I started following Greg. And like me, he has also worked with McKinsey. And he is an executive coach working with psychedelics and also the founder of the True Nature Retreat Center. Why am I interested in interviewing Greg? I think psychedelics is a fascinating field. I have some experience with it myself. I've had mostly positive experiences. But at the same time, I know that not everyone in my own environment knows about it. And it's still sometimes controversial. So one of my intentions with this episode is to kind of demystify psychedelics, get a better understanding about what psychedelics is, what the pros are, the cons, and of course also learn from the journey of Greg, from being a McKinsey person to, let's say, a psychedelic pioneer. Is not something that you hear every day. So Greg, did I miss something in introducing you or introducing this episode?
I think I'm a proud father of three, although that is sometimes I think the most challenging task in the world. But, you know, apart from that, you did an awesome job. Thank you.
I think that's a very good addition. So maybe we can start with that topic. I think I saw on LinkedIn one of your recent posts about fatherhood and about having a family, that it's very different from maybe what you expected when you were younger. So can you maybe share a bit about your experiences of being a father?
Yeah, for sure. So I've got three amazing kids, but the amazing kids are very little emotional or big emotional human beings, actually. And I had this kind of naive, romantic view of family life, that we would be playing board games every night and that we would be hugging all the time. But the reality, of course, is a bit different from that. It's three little individuals that you cannot mold, you know, so you wish that you could control them, but you cannot control them. And every day is a bit of a challenge because there's a lot of emotions, there's a lot of fighting, unfortunately, going on here. And kids are the biggest mirror, right? So all of the, let's say, behaviors that you wish not to see in yourself, like getting worked up and getting stressed out, and sometimes even yelling, unfortunately, come out because of the kids. So that is, it's a difficult task. But at the same time, I guess that the paradox is that you love these little human beings so much, you know, even much more than anyone else in the world, that it is sometimes difficult to unite those feelings of extreme love. And sometimes you're just like, oh, just for F's sake, leave me alone. So it's definitely a big challenge, right? And I think that a lot of us who have parents, in a way, we want to do like our parents, like reenact what we've gotten, or just we try not to do what our parents did to us, or actually not give us, right? So in a way, then you can actually overcompensate certain behaviors that you didn't get in the past, or that you got in the past. It's difficult to find your true nature when it comes to parenthood, actually.
So you mentioned that your children, they're mirroring parts of yourself that you were maybe unaware of. So you already mentioned yelling, but can you maybe give a recent example when one of your characteristics were mirrored by your children?
Well, I think I'm an emotional human being as well. I think that, you know, all of us are emotional human beings, but in a way that I've learned to kind of be strong and look at my emotions from a rational point of view. See what I mean? And I have this daughter of mine. She's the first daughter and my second child. And she's like a uber emotional human being. So whatever happens, she will either throw a tantrum or become sad or what have you. So there's very little emotional regulation, actually. And I've taught myself actually to maybe even regulate my emotions a bit too much. So in a way, she is, you know, showing the opposite of what I taught myself, which is difficult to handle, actually. So I down-regulated and she up-regulated her emotions. So all of this drive is coming from her. I love her to pieces, but sometimes I'm like, oh.
I think by sharing these examples, you're showing kind of reality also on social media. That's also kind of how you stand out from some other people. I mean, not from everyone, but from some other people. So what's your underlying motivation for sharing those life experiences on a platform like LinkedIn?
Yeah, I think I want to keep it real. It's going to sound like a cliche, but there's a lot of posts where people are, let's say they say that everything about entrepreneurship is good, or everything about relationship is good, or everything about kids is good, but you know, it's that is not the case. You know what I mean? So I love to just keep it real, and I love to talk as well from my own situation, because I think that being authentic and vulnerable actually leads to connection with human beings, and that's what I've seen as well. And I think that people can relate with the fact that parenthood actually is beautiful, but at the same time, sometimes you just want to shout and run away. See what I mean? So, and that level of relatability is appreciated. At least that's what I see from the impressions that I get on my posts. For me, authenticity, it depends on person per person, right? But that's really high up my value ladder, like authenticity and being open about the struggles of life. And in a way, I think that life is, you know, about struggles and how you overcome struggles. And, you know, some people are born with more positivism, let's say, or positivity than others. And I'm like the person, I'm a realist who keeps it real. So I can be very positive, but I can be negative as well. And I end up somewhere in the middle. It's just the way, you know, who I am. And I'm not saying that my way is better, but it's my posts are who I am, basically. There is no sugarcoating. And I appreciate authenticity, and I appreciate it in others as well. But I respect that some people don't respect that. See what I mean? Everyone is, built in a different fashion and has different values, and that is okay as well.
So you're openly sharing struggles that you sometimes have related to entrepreneurship or fatherhood, and core values that you have are authenticity and vulnerability. So I'm curious, to what extent have your experiences with psychedelics contributed to becoming more authentic and vulnerable?
Well, hugely, actually. I think that after the use of psychedelics, I mean, the name of my company is True Nature. I believe that as human beings, we have all become a certain person, and that is thanks to and due to our context. So the system that we grew up in, the family of our origin, the school, certain beliefs that you associate with, because it helps you to survive in the world. And psychedelics actually, they work a bit like a car wash, basically. So they, whatever belief that you may have, you're able to challenge, and you can say whether you want to still, let's say, adhere to that belief or not. So they give you freedom of choice, basically. And they have definitely helped me, because I've come to accept many more facets of who I am. And one of them is, you know, I love the fact of being an entrepreneur. But at the same time, I believe that maybe entrepreneurship for me is what I'm currently doing. I'm a solopreneur. And that is basically what I like the most. And I think that psychedelics have helped me to understand that is my definition of entrepreneurship. That is one. I think being myself as well, you may notice, I don't know, but I have earrings. My hair is blonde. It used to be brownish, and like expressing myself has become much more important to me. And it may sound trivial, dyeing your hair blonde or the earrings, but these are things that I always wanted to do but never dared to do so, because I was brought up in a system, especially my mom's mom, who is amazing, but she was you know, Catholic, and she was always saying, you know, what will the others think? See what I mean? So I was kind of brought up with that mentality, you know, be careful because the others may think a certain something of you. So I was always fighting against, let's say, expressing myself. Or at least when I did, I felt a bit sorry. See what I mean? And the psychedelics have really helped me to say, no, this is who you are, speak your truth. And if you do so from a base of, you know, an ecological base, then it's okay. You know, and if you trigger people, the trigger is on them. It's not on you. I mean, who could be offended with me dyeing my hair blonde or, you know, having earrings? So yeah, that is a certain something on them, and I cannot control that, what happens in the other human being. But that's what I mean with ecological, having an earring or blonde hair or, you know, being a solopreneur. That's ecological because you're not hurting anyone else. I think that as of the moment that your behavior is hurting someone else, and of course, that is a different story, different question.
So psychedelics give you a freedom of choice, and they make you question certain beliefs or give you the opportunity to choose again.
Yeah.
And let's say your grandmother was Catholic and was thinking more like, hey, what would others think? And then psychedelics gives you the power to think for yourself. You start to express yourself more. And around solo entrepreneurship, can you elaborate specifically why that's important to you, or why you've chosen that and how that's related to a psychedelic experience?
Well, I think that for me, one of my core values, and I think that a lot of people will relate to this value, is freedom. And freedom to me is being able to choose what I do, with whom I do it, how much I do it, and when I do it, right? And solopreneurship actually gives me that freedom. With True Nature, I do have a partner, an associate, but he's not active in the operations of the company. So it's someone who invested and is actually one of my best friends. But I'm free to do whatever I want to do. And I think that is what I mean with this kind of freedom, and why solopreneurship to date helps with that. I've you know, for a long time, I was judging myself, you know, why is it that I don't want to work with people? I do work with people because I have freelance psychologists and MDs who work with me on the retreats. But when it comes to the daily management, I make all of the decisions, right? And in the past, I used to be kind of judgmental, like, why am I not able to work with other people? See what I mean? Other people wounded me, so I need to, I need to come to terms with the wound, basically, and I need to open up to other people and other people's opinions and what have you. So it's important for me to work again in a context where there's many more people deciding. And I've just come to terms with the facts, thanks to the psychedelics, that it's okay to be who you are. You see what I mean? I mean, solopreneurship, again, is an ecological decision. I'm not hurting anyone by saying no to another venture. Well, at the same time, I'm open still to working with people, but it needs to be on my terms as well. See what I mean? So I'm not going to quickly again embark on a certain kind of journey because it sounds interesting or looks shiny. And that used to be the case in the past, you know?
Yeah.
This
one resonates with me. I've also worked with other shareholders and business partners, and I've had mostly positive experiences. So I definitely don't regret it. And I've never ended up in a fight, but it's definitely very challenging. And now with Soul Kitchen, I'm really enjoying also solo entrepreneurship. Mm. So I understand that you've been accepting that part of yourself. And I know psychedelics is something maybe more to be experienced than to be explained. But can you make an attempt to explain, let's say, in a certain psychedelic journey, what then kind of happens in your mind or in your body or your feeling, that you have this aha moment, like, solo entrepreneurship might be for me. Can you try to explain that?
Yeah, it's a very good question, but it's a very difficult question because I think that with psychedelics, two things happen. One is you have the psychedelic experience itself, and then there's the mind manifestation. So psychedelic actually means manifestation of the mind. And there's certain kind of stories that pass by, right? So you can see your mom, your dad, past colleagues, past experiences, basically. And from those let's say from that kind of cinematographic event, you can distill some key insights, right? You can see your father, you can forgive your father, you can see your mom and feel the love for your mom, you can see your kids and feel the love for your kids, and those can be affirmations of what you knew or kind of manifestations of something that is new that you didn't know. That is the one thing. So that is what happens during the psychedelic trip. But for me as well, that's how I explain it to a lot of the participants. There's a lot that happens behind the scenes that is not manifested during the psychedelic trip, right? And those are things like the solopreneurship. I've never had anything during a psychedelic trip about solopreneurship. But what I did have after psychedelic trips is that I felt that the decisions that I was taking were much more in line with my true self, with what I wanted to do and what I wanted to be in this world as well. So I think there's two things happening. To recap, one is you have that kind of, you know, cinema of events, and you can distill certain kind of insights and you take them with you. And then there's everything that happens behind the scenes. You know, you're actually going, you're actually behaving much more in line with your true nature. But that hasn't really manifested itself during the psychedelic trip. It's more the kind of benefits that you're getting after the psychedelic trip.
Mm. Thank you for explaining that. And you mentioned after, which I think is also sometimes called the integration. So can you also share how these aftermath / integration works and why it is relevant?
Yeah. I think there's a couple of things that I'd like to stress here. Like, we work with healthy participants, so we're not a clinic. It's important to note the difference. Healthy participants are people like you and me who feel like they can achieve, for instance, more in life, or they want to be healthier in life and happier in life. And they come to us from a kind of personal development perspective and goal. So, and then you have people who go to the clinic who are surrounded by doctors and nurses who want to fight, for instance, post-traumatic stress disorder or treatment-resistant depression, right? And I think that when it comes to integration practices, like I organize psychedelic retreats, the third day is all about integrating. What did you see? What is it basically that you want to acknowledge? What is it basically that you want to let go of? What is an action that you can take that will actually lead to greater performance / satisfaction, well-being? And then we have a follow-up call as well, where we'll make sure that the people still feel okay, and to make sure that they're actually going into the direction that they said they would be going. So that is what we mean with integration. And with integration, we mean we're going to talk, we're going to do yoga, we're going to do breath work, we're going to do journaling as well, so writing down everything that has happened to you. And there's going to be that part of the accountability person who's going to follow up with you to see whether you went through with all the things that you said you would be going through. That is what we do. Integration, when it comes to it's not a word that I like, but let's say people with depression or PTSD, for me is much more important in that group, because those people are, for instance, clinically depressed, and they want to get out of that depression. So it's really important that they get next to the psychedelic trip, the psychotherapy that is going to help them as well with fighting the depression. So integration is important, but I do see a difference between the clinical, or let's say the clinically ill, and then people, healthy people, quote unquote, like you and me, who do it from a personal development perspective. At the same time, we do put a lot of stress on it, that they need to continue the journaling, they need to continue the breath work, the body work, the movement, the yoga. So that is still very important.
You focus on the so-called healthy people that come to you mainly from a personal development point of view. I see it as a compliment that you consider me a healthy person. I'm happy to hear that. but can you give maybe one or two case examples of your clients, like what they have experienced, what they changed in themselves, and like the topics they've been working on?
Yeah, definitely. Maybe I can share an example of myself because that would be truest to the truth, basically. So I've always wanted to express myself in a creative fashion. And after a psychedelic trip, I decided to start DJing, but not only to start DJing, but basically go out there and to perform. So last year I had 6 gigs, basically, and I even played at a festival. I was opening the festival. It was a new festival. So that is one thing. You know, I've always had this creativity inside me, but I never gave it an outlet. And secondly, I started writing poetry as well. So it gave me this kind of, I don't know, like the balls, if I may say so, to go there and to present myself in all of my vulnerability. And that would have never happened without the psychedelics. So in a way, it unlocks your true self. And it's really hard to keep that person in the closet. You know, you want to break out. So that's at least my experience. And then, of course, there's a couple of more with one of my participants who was a freelance management consultant who always wanted to become an entrepreneur, but never dared to do so. So a bit stuck in the golden cage, you know, earning X amount of money per day and being able to build 200 to 220 days a year. So you can do the maths as well. See what I mean? So in a way, he wasn't ready to let go of that financial stability. And after the psychedelic trip, or actually two, because he came back the year after, which you see often that people come back after a year, by the way, he started his entrepreneurship journey. But it's an and story. So he kept his freelancing job, but at the same time, he's looking to invest in a restaurant, for instance, and he wants to start as well a freelance platform. So actually mapping, let's say, opportunities at companies with freelance consultants who are available. So that is a success story. But at the same time, like, psychedelics are non-selective amplifiers. And I told you that I like to keep it real, right? So I like to talk about the truth as well. At the same time, I've had a person leaving her husband, so asking for a divorce, because that was already inside of her. You see what I mean? She was not happy in the marriage, but she didn't see it this way, or she was covering it up. And the psychedelics actually showed her that she was unhappy and enabled her to take that decision, a very difficult decision. And I'm pretty sure that she suffered from that decision. But it you know, psychedelics are non-selective amplifiers, so they will amplify what lives inside of you in a non-selective fashion. So you cannot choose. They bring you what you need to get at the moment that you're doing psychedelics. So we've had a divorce as well. So we have a lot of success stories, but sometimes, you know, the success story is first disguised in a painful breakup.
Yeah. So it means that what's already there gets amplified and unlocking your true self. So people are leaving a cage. Yeah. I like examples. I have a friend, he might listen. He's also a freelance management consulting, but I think he wants to do something different. But it can be difficult, right, to break that cage. Because it can also be maybe that you're attached to certain money or status.
Yeah.
So a lot of times when people have a certain dream, they have to let go of something, right? It could be money, it could be a certain status. So to what extent does psychedelics have an influence on certain beliefs around money and status?
Oh, they do. I mean, it's like, maybe an anecdote, but in the 70s, psychedelics got prohibited by Nixon, and he gave them this kind of classification, Schedule 1, so highly addictive and not therapeutic, which is a lie, because they're very therapeutic. And for instance, psilocybin from mushrooms is not addictive whatsoever. But he did so because he felt that people would challenge his decision to go to Vietnam. See what I mean? So like deeply ingrained beliefs are definitely challenged by psychedelics. But of course, it's not because it is challenged that you will actually undo the belief. You still need to put the work in. You see what I mean? You're offered, let's say, this kind of new vision on that belief. And then it's still up to you to decide whether you want to put the effort in to actually completely unravel and undo that belief. And some of them are like deeply ingrained, right? If you come from a youth where your parents didn't have a lot of money, see what I mean? And then you're in a job that gives you that financial stability and maybe even gives you money that your parents never had, then it's very difficult to let go of that. So in a way, psychedelics show you what is possible, but you still need to put the effort in. I often use the metaphor of seeing Rome. See what I mean? You can see Rome, but I live in Belgium and Flanders, so I may, you know, one day see Rome, but I still need to walk to Rome, right? So I know that the possibility is there, and in the past I wouldn't have known that Rome was there, but now I need to still walk or bike or whatever to Rome.
Yeah. I see. So you get new perspectives, but you still have to make the decisions yourself. And before we go into the history of psychedelics, I'm curious if you can share a bit more, because there's different types. I wrote a few notes. So there's magic mushrooms, psilocybin, there's LSD, DMT, mescaline, MDMA. So how do you know which one to use? And for instance, my dad is a medical doctor, and one of his concerns of modern time is that a lot of people use psychedelics for maybe recreational purpose, or they're like, people become their own therapist, they do some Google, and then they find something without really knowing which one to use. So what is your perspective on that?
It's a very good question. Again, I think that psychedelics have been used for thousands of years, actually, and I think what we're now trying to do is basically come up with decision trees, right? When should I use psychedelics and for what should I be using psychedelics? But in the past, you know, Mesoamerican tribes didn't have a decision tree either. See what I mean? They used it because they wanted to have access to certain kinds of knowledge. And that's how they used it, or because they wanted to heal as well past wounds. So this is why they used it, basically. So so that is one thing I wanted to say. Let's not try to westernize too much the use of psychedelics. And that's what you see with Big Pharma as well. Psychedelics is now hot and they want to synthesize psychedelics so that they can have a certain kind of market share. So, you know, that's I think it's a bit of a disease of the Westerner to always try to westernize everything that they see. At the same time, of course, psychedelics are here now. So, and I do think that life is all about, you know, nuance. And I think it's important that people understand as well that psychedelics are not... Yeah, they're very transformative. They can really leave you with this sense of, you know, oh my God, everything that I believed in, everything that I held on to is swept away. So what is the framework that I'll be operating from or in now? So they can be super transformative and a bit unsettling as well. So I do think that it's important as well that we know what we're doing and what psychedelics that we're taking, with whom that we're taking it, and you know, in which context that we're taking it. So it's important that people feel at ease. It's important as well that people do it from a certain kind of intention as well, I'd say, with people who are, let's say, to be trusted or qualified. That I do think needs to happen. I've used it recreationally, psychedelics, and in an intentional setting, let's say, with intentional setting, I mean from a kind of personal development perspective, I've never had a bad experience. I think I once had a bad experience, and that was when I was using psychedelics in a festival setting, because there was just too much music, there were too many people, and I didn't feel comfortable. You know, it was just too many stimuli, right? So you said the setting was not the best. And my mindset was to party. It wasn't a personal development incentive. So sometimes they can be a bit unsettling, and then you need to work on make sure that the mindset is okay and that the setting is okay. Yeah. And then which kind of psychedelic? You need to read into psychedelics as well. I mean, when we talk about ayahuasca, the principal ingredient is DMT. DMT can lead to purging. You see what I mean? Purging is vomiting or actually having diarrhea. That can be a super transformative, yet again, very unsettling experience. So the question is, where will you do this and with whom will you do so, and do you feel at ease? Psilocybin is less of that purging. You won't have the vomiting, you won't have the diarrhea. But then when you look at it from a clinical perspective, I mean, ayahuasca, LSD, and psilocybin are all very effective against depression, but ayahuasca will be the most effective until now. So there is a kind of potentially correlation between, you know, there is not only the manifestation in the mind and the hallucinations that is happening, but as well the purging. And I think that the kind of extent to which you are experiencing, not only in the mind, but through the body as well, the psychedelic will actually be correlated with the extent to which it is effective against, for instance, treatment-resistant depression. So that is ayahuasca. We have iboga that is used in Western Africa, and that can have some serious adverse effects on the heart, for instance. So that is a certain something that you need to take into account as well. I think it's very important for people to read into what they do and then make sure that they're in the right sit with the right people around them in order to make sure that they can experience a safe trip. But every psychedelic can have different, let's say, experiences or outcomes. And even with the same psychedelic, you can have a different outcome. So it's hard to predict.
So set and setting are important. It's, of course, very important to read into the implications. But if you are a beginner, let's say you've never done it, is there one of the psychedelics that is more recommended than the others, as if there's like a hierarchy from beginner to advanced, or that's not the case?
It's a good question. Some of the psychedelics are more, to me at least, powerful than others. Like if I were a beginner, I wouldn't start with ayahuasca, but that's my opinion. Of the fact that it is, you have this kind of purging effects, for instance. DMT is very powerful as well. It's what you can find in ayahuasca, but sometimes it's synthesized and singled out and you can smoke it. It lasts not very long, 5 minutes to 25, 30 minutes, but it can have a very profound impact as well. 5-MeO-DMT that comes from Bufo, like the frog that you basically could plastically lick, right, is a very powerful psychedelic as well, and I wouldn't recommend it to first-time users. I think if the Lancet once did a harm score assessment, and psilocybin is ranked as the least harmful substance around, and psilocybin you can get from magic mushrooms and magic truffles. Magic mushrooms is the fruiting bloom, and the truffle is what you can find, a mycelium beneath that will feed the magic mushroom. So I do think that in terms of safety profile, you should start with mushrooms and truffles. Yeah.
So mushroom and truffle is a good starting point. So we can discuss, let's say, how those psychedelics are different from each other, and let's say the benefits and maybe potentially risks. But when I was preparing this interview, I also saw, let's say, a risk analysis of, for instance, alcohol versus psychedelics. So what is your view on alcohol versus psychedelics, and let's say pros and cons? That's maybe question A. And question B, why is alcohol culturally more accepted in mainstream culture than psychedelics?
Yeah, well, alcohol, I need to make sure that I don't become too emotional, but alcohol is neurotoxic. So it causes, it can cause cancer, it shrinks your brain. It has no pluses, no advantages. The only advantage it has is that it is, or it acts as a social lubricant, right? So if you feel a bit uncomfortable with your mates or with your family, see what I mean? Alcohol can help you as well to just loosen up. So in a way, it helps you with potentially uncomfortable situations. If you look at psilocybin, and you from the safety profile, like alcohol scores 72 out of 100. You know, this is the scientific study that I was referring to that was done by The Lancet. So 72 out of 100. It tops all of the substances. It's the most harmful substance around alcohol. So that is according to that research, right? And then the least harmful substance is actually a magic mushroom. So, and that is scientific evidence, right? So for the people who like scientific evidence, I do as well, right? They need to know that alcohol is actually the most harmful drug or substance around. But of course, historically, right? So, you know, we've had a culture of brewing wine. I think it started in Georgia 8,000 years ago, right? So people didn't necessarily have access to fresh water. And in the Middle Ages, neither, so they couldn't drink water because it was contaminated, so they had to drink alcohol because it was fermented, right? So for thousands of years we have cultivated the art of making wine and beer, and sometimes the only thing that we could do was actually drink wine or beer. And of course it's nice to sometimes just let go and loosen up, right? But psychedelics have been used as well for thousands of years. It's only when religion came, especially in Mesoamerica, that they prohibited the use of psychedelics because they saw it as something that was going against Christianity. I'm now using Christianity as an example for Mesoamerica. See what I mean? So they saw people as pagans for the use of psychedelics. And then, of course, in, you know, there was a lot of very good work done in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, and even 60s. And then Nixon said, no, we need to have a ban on psychedelics because we cannot control psychedelics. So there's a couple of things. You had like Christianity, the Middle Ages, and then you had Nixon as well that put a ban on psychedelics. And unfortunately, it is part of our semantics as well because, I mean, we see psychedelics as drugs, right? We don't see alcohol as drugs. So as a consequence, everything that is not alcohol becomes a drug. See what I mean? Mm-hmm. And we have this kind of connotation in our head that drugs are bad, but actually alcohol is bad for you, and that's the truth.
That's a very interesting, right? That alcohol is actually very bad, but at the same time it's culturally accepted. So you have alcohol and drugs, and then you have drugs and psychedelics. So what I still don't understand is what is the difference in your opinion between alcohol, drugs, and psychedelics? And I feel there's a lot of confusion, not for me but for other people, that like you know, alcohol is okay, drugs is not good, psychedelics is weird. Like, what how would you explain the differences?
I think the difference for me at least is therapeutic benefits. See what I mean? Are there any therapeutic benefits? I think that's a very important criterion. And what is the level of addiction? See what I mean? Potential to actually be addictive. I think those are the most important criterions. Alcohol has no therapeutic benefits and is highly addictive. Point. Yeah. I mean, you know, when it comes to psychedelics, they are highly therapeutical. See what I mean? Of course, some of them can be addictive. Like, I think that to a certain extent, ketamine is more addictive than psilocybin, for instance. So ketamine is currently being used as well in, you know, in when people go out, when people go rave, to dance to electronic music. So I guess that for a certain, let's say, for the people out there, ketamine has gotten a really bad name. But ketamine is actually a very good sedative and a very good psychedelic. But of course, you need to control the environment and the quantity that you use. So for me, the two most important things is, one, therapeutic benefits, and two, the level of, you know, the degree to which you can get addicted to the substance.
So as, let's say, ex-McKinsey consultant, we can make like a matrix, right, with the therapeutic benefits and the level of addiction. So alcohol is addictive and no therapeutic benefits. Maybe I didn't listen correctly. Sometimes I'm dreaming away. So psychedelics has therapeutic benefits, but it's not so addictive, right?
And at least a lot of them, right? Yeah. And some of them are more addictive than others.
Yeah, and then drugs?
Well, drugs to me, it's difficult, right? What, you know, what's in a name? But when you look at, for instance, crack or heroin or coke or speed, for me, those would be as well in the same range as alcohol, right? Because they have no therapeutic benefits and they're highly addictive. So, and if you look again at the study, and maybe you can show or maybe you can't show, you will see as well that I think that closely following alcohol, you will find heroin, and you will find certain kind of methamphetamines and crack. So those are the most, I'd say, dangerous drugs. But until now, all of them are called drugs, right? You have alcohol being a drug, and you've got psilocybin from shrooms and truffles being called a drug as well. So I think we need to work a little bit, as you're trying to do so, on the wording, on the semantics and the use of
it. So alcohol is also considered a drug, and psychedelics are also considered drugs, but they have therapeutic value. And then if you bring another thing in the mix, like caffeine, I mean, a lot of people like a beer or a wine, but also a lot of people like a cup of coffee. So how does caffeine relate to the things we've been discussing?
It's again a very good question. For sure, it's a substance that is addictive, right? Because when you don't drink caffeine anymore, you get withdrawal symptoms. So people get headaches and cravings for caffeine. So for sure, it's highly addictive. The thing with caffeine is that there's two things. It has a lot of health benefits, especially, for instance, in men, because it can help fight prostate cancer, or, you know, you don't develop prostate cancer. So it can actually be very beneficial to you. And it has some short-term gains as well, because you get more focused and it's actually performance enhancing. And a lot of runners, I mean, I run now as well, they will use caffeine 40 minutes before they actually need to do a run or a race, because it's going to boost their performance. So it's definitely performance enhancing. I think a negative of caffeine, or too much caffeine, of course, is that it's gonna cause sleep havoc. That is, you know, is again scientifically proven as well. So if you drink too much caffeine or caffeine after a certain hour, the quality of sleep will be reduced. And sleep is the holy grail. So if you reduce sleep quality, basically your performance will lead under it as well. It's not on the list of the Lancet, but it's definitely a substance that is addictive, but it is performance enhancing. So you need to use it in a clever fashion. Yeah.
I see. Well, it's fascinating how all these things are differentiating and kind of the nuances. I'm following someone, she's also ex-McKinsey, actually, Els van der Helm. She's a sleep expert. And now she's sharing the misconceptions, or kind of the myth about sleep. So what are kind of the top three misconceptions about psychedelics if we want to, let's say, demystify psychedelics?
I think is that a lot of people think that they will have a bad trip, but, you know, we have not had, I think we've had 100 participants and one had a challenging trip. So that's one out of 100. So they're usually very intense and profound, but when guided under the right circumstances with the right people, like we have a doctor in sight or a emergency nurse and a clinical psychologist, when they're done under the right circumstances, you reduce them to such an extent that you won't have a bad trip. I think that is one, you know, myth that needs to be debunked. Two, I mean, we referred to as well just now that they're addictive. They're not addictive, or close to not addictive, especially when you compare it with all of the other substances / drugs around. So that's important for people to know as well. And in a way, this is the third point, that you're losing control. A lot of people think that they are losing control, that you completely pass out and that you're not capable of doing anything anymore, but that's not the case. They make you go into a lucid dreaming state. So it's like you don't sleep, but you have the need to close your eyes and to go into this kind of world that is created for you, but you can still stand up, you can go to the loo, you can talk. So these are things I guess that people need to know as well. You're not completely passed out.
So a bad trip is actually a tiny percentage. They're not addictive and you not necessarily lose control. So these are interesting myths to demystify. And if we look, I mean, we talked about what psychedelics is, the different elements, but if you look at the history, so it has been used for thousands of years. It has also been suggested that some of the great philosophers have used it. And for instance, I read a book about the history of LSD because I was curious about the historical cultural thing. Is that I think in the 1950s, the CIA saw potential in these things for their research. and they were kind of more accepted in, let's say, by the political establishment. But then in the 1960s, I think there came a counterculture, and at some point Richard Nixon had this war on drugs. And then for decades, it was kind of a taboo topic. But now you have this psychedelic renaissance, Silicon Valley is investing. And in our circles, it's getting more and more accepted. I don't know, maybe I already answered the question for 10%, but this is kind of my understanding, but you probably know more than I do. So can you take us a little bit on the historical developments and why it has been more accepted and less accepted and why it's now getting more accepted? Can you share some insights?
Well, you know, as I said, and you said, so they've been used for thousands of years. They've been used in Mesoamerica, but they've been used in Europe as well. The ancient Greek had a concoction that was called Kikeon. And in Kikeon, they found ergot. And ergot is actually, at least the fungus on ergot, is what led to Hoffman synthesizing LSD in the 40s for Sandoz, right? So, you know, for thousands of years, the Greeks were already experimenting with ergot and the fungus on ergot to, you know, come to certain kind of truths. You see what I mean? So the Greek used it, ancient Greek used it. They used it in Mesoamerica as well. Mexico, that's really the cradle of the psilocybin mushroom. So they've been using that for thousands of years as well. And they found evidence when excavating, and they found certain kind of amphora, for instance. They found psychedelics inside of them as well. They have as well images of being, you know, of mushrooms being revered, or of important people in that age holding mushrooms, in a way revering the mushroom as well. So that is a, you know, a way for us to know that they've been used for thousands of years, and that they were revered for thousands of years as well for their, you know, I presume, magical characteristics. Yeah. So thousands of years, but then with Christianity, they got kind of forbidden as well. And then, of course, let's say that when there was a lot of science being done, they came to a lot of you know, benefits, you know, when it came to psychedelics, and a lot of scientists actually coming up with a lot of designer psychedelics as well. They've always been, they've always inspired people to use them and to keep on working with them and synthesizing them for different kind of purposes. But then, as I said, in the 70s, you had Nixon, and he came with his war on drugs as well, because Timothy Leary, actually in the 60s, said that everyone should have access basically to psychedelics and to form their own opinion about everything that was going on. So in a way, Nixon tried to thwart that, and he called them Schedule One drugs, so no therapeutic benefits and highly addictive. And that was the case for years and years and years. You could find some very small pockets of, let's say, scientific centers still experimenting with psychedelics, but a lot of that research was funded by themselves, so they didn't have sufficient money basically to run big, large clinical studies, and they cost hundreds of millions of euros actually to make, let's say, the use of psychedelics again widespread. But it came like, you know, they continued doing so in some states in the US and in Switzerland as well, especially to treat certain kind of medical conditions such as depression. And with the use of, let's say, LSD in a microdose and psilocybin in a microdose as well, and psilocybin, all of a sudden it led to a surge again. And, you know, with that surge came money, and with money came the proof that they are highly therapeutic. So we still live in a capitalist model. So when, you know, when there's, let's say, proof or evidence and you can make bucks or money out of it, then you will get extra money, and that extra money will then lead to more companies being founded.
Yeah. So thanks for sharing a bit the history. So talking about money, I saw that the psychedelic industry was worth $3 billion in 2021 and $8 billion in 2029, which is an incredible growth. So why do venture capital investors see the money now, or why do we see this huge acceleration? I mean, we haven't talked about business yet, but from a business point of view, it's also quite a fascinating industry. So why is this acceleration so large now?
I think there's a couple of answers to that. I do think that it's shrinking again. Last year, we had Synthesis Institute go bankrupt. That is one. We saw Field Trip as well go bankrupt. So a lot of the big players actually are going bankrupt as well, because I think on the one hand side, there was a bit of mismanagement, as I read. On the other hand side, I do think that they may think that the demand is actually bigger than it, you know, the real demands, and they have set up shop to such an extent that their cost base was too high, and then they went bankrupt. I think that is one thing. So I do think that the market is a bit smaller, and you need to fight against the black market as well. I think that cannabis went through the same story, right? So you have, especially in the States, the psychedelic underground market is so huge. You have products such as MDMA and psilocybin, chocolate with barcodes even, and see what I mean? Like, and it's not even legal. So it's such a big market. And then as an official player, you need to, you know, kind of fight against a really big underground market. So I think that makes it a little bit more difficult as well. But at the same time, of course, I mean, 14%, according to Booking, 14% of travelers, 14%, are looking for some kind of mind-altering experience in 2024. That's 14%. So it's still a very huge market. And you see that people become more and more aware, and you see that people are much more interested in personal development and in coaching, and they're looking for alternative methods. And that's how you get to psychedelics as well. And psychedelics are currently being used to enhance performance. And when you you know, when you talk about leadership, that is definitely of interest to leaders as well, because they have so many things to do that anything that is potentially performance in enhancing, that they will definitely consider. So there's the market that is definitely growing because of the interest in personal development, leadership development, the use of psychedelics in Silicon Valley. However, I think it was a bit bigger than it was a bit smaller than they thought it was. And then you have Big Pharma as well. Big Pharma are definitely interested in psychedelics because, yeah, they've been selling SSRIs, like classical antidepressants, SSRIs and SNRIs for ages now. And we've had doctors, especially in Belgium, that love to prescribe antidepressants. So if psychedelics come and they fight treatment-resistant depression, what happens is that these big pharma companies, unfortunately, won't be able to sell so many drugs, prescription drugs anymore, because they need to fight against the psychedelics. So what they want to do is synthesize the magic mushrooms so they can be used in a clinical setting as well. In such a way, they try to, you know, become again the market leaders by synthesizing these natural plant medicine products. So there's, you know, there's an interest of many parties actually, you know, to invest in psychedelics or to make psychedelics a new business line. Yeah.
Well, I like that comprehensive answer. And one of the things I did not expect is that Booking.com did a research. Yeah. For 3 years, I was a trainer at the Booking.com startup program. So I work with travel ventures with Booking.com. And so they've done research that travelers are looking for mind-altering experiences. And you also say people are becoming more aware. So what, in your opinion, does it mean to become aware? What is awareness?
Oh, yeah, that's, again, a very good question. But that's at least what I see around me, right? I think that we, as human beings, we are reaching a new level of awareness, right? And a lot of us see that the way we are doing things until now is not the right way forward, right? So we see when it comes to sustainability and circular economies that we need to do something because we're basically depleting the natural resources of the earth. So there's a lot of questions around how we as human beings are currently behaving. And that's what I mean with that level of increased self-awareness. You know what I mean? You see as well that there's a lot of psychologists who try to make psychology a commonality. Like there's a brilliant account on Instagram. It's called The Holistic Psychologist. She has more than X million followers. And she's trying to educate the people on, you know, psychology. And with psychology, I mean childhood trauma, being in abusive relationships. So people get access to much more knowledge than before. And with the knowledge, they basically project themselves into that knowledge, and they say, hey, maybe my mom or my dad's, you know, what they did wasn't the correct thing. Or, hey, maybe I'm in a relationship where I feel that my partner is always being the victim. See what I mean? So, you know, getting access to that knowledge and like projecting you into that context leads to increased levels of self-awareness. And then people want to do something about that. And then they find their way to, you know, psychotherapist, clinical psychologist. But a lot of them actually, and that's what I see from my personal experience, after a while, they are a little bit underwhelmed by classical therapy, because they say a lot of what I hear or a lot of the conclusions that I get to with classical therapy is knowledge that I know, but I'm not getting to the necessary breakthroughs. And then they find their way to psychedelics because, you know, this was mentioned in a scientific study as well, but it's, you know, said by participants, so it's kind of subjective. But a lot of them describe a psychedelic trip as 10 years of psychotherapy in one, whereas 100 hours of therapy in one. So in a way, it is a catalyst for personal development or for therapy, actually.
So what I'm hearing you say is that you reach new levels of awareness related to maybe your behavior, your childhood, your traumas, your beliefs, which in a way is a good thing. To what extent is this related to, because Timothy Leary is one of the important figures in the hysterical movement that you talked about earlier, and he said turn on, tune in, drop out. So to what extent is this awareness related to like turn on? Is that like the same, or is he talking about different stuff?
No. He wanted to have broad and general access to psychedelics and to go against, he's not saying it literally, to go against the establishment, right? So to be very critical of the knowledge that is given to you. That was his point of view. And I do think that we are reaching such a state, again, maybe facilitated by the use of psychedelics or other kinds of, you know, therapies that help you actually to, you know, challenge what is going on. I mean, there's a lot of people who are not in accordance with what is currently going on in Gaza without taking a stance here. People are becoming more critical. See what I mean? So, you know, of course, with that, you have a kind of counter movement as well, where people want to hold on to what is dear to them, you know, so you will find some right-wing movements as well, where people say, you know, it's important that, you know, we keep, let's say, resources to ourselves, and we don't share them with anyone. So, I think that people are more critical of what is going on. And maybe that's seen as well with the Gen Z, as well, that people will rebel against the ancient working regimes and schedules as well, where work is not seen anymore as the holy grail, but work is seen as just one way to express yourself. See what I mean? So I do feel that there's a lot of challenge going on in the world. So I don't want to call it turmoil, but there's a lot going on. And I believe that comes from a raised awareness, whether that is coming from, I mean, it can be from psychedelics or it can be from any other kinds of means. But I see that people are not necessarily settling with the status quo anymore.
Yeah. That's interesting what you say, that Gen Z says work as one way of expressing themselves, but you can express yourself in different ways. So how has psychedelics influenced your view on work and the role it plays in your life?
Yeah, for me at least, I think work is important. At least it is important to me. I guess it should be important to a lot of people as well, because yeah, almost the majority of your time is spent working, right? So I think it would be pity if you were stuck with a job that is not fueling you with energy for 80%. Of course, I think it's safe to think that a job would fuel you with 100% energy, but they may be out there, those jobs. So I do think it's important that you find something that is fueling you with energy, and psychedelics help with that. At least they help me, because now I do psychedelic retreats. And when I do those psychedelic retreats, I really feel that I'm in the middle of my ikigai, right? What I can do well, what gives me energy, what pays to a certain extent, and how I help humanity. So that's my situation. So they can help with work, with finding your purpose, with finding, you know, energy from what you do. That is one thing. But I think that even if you don't make that radical change, like going from corporate to solopreneurship, that even in the job that you do, that you can optimize the way that you do your work as well, by saying no maybe to certain tasks that you no longer want to do. Again, I think that it shows you to a certain extent or to a large extent your true nature, and that that is expressed via work as well. And either it is to be found in your current job, or you pivot towards another job. And that's at least what I've seen with a lot of my participants as well. We had one CEO who took a sabbatical, who went on a psychedelic retreat. And then after the psychedelic retreat, he went for a different function in his company. And then after a while, after 6 months or so, he started a completely new function in a new company. Definitely psychedelics helped him there. I have another person who has been in a very shitty situation at work as well, a lot of stress, who's done 2 psychedelic trips and is now ready to say goodbye to his job as a CEO because it's not fueling him with energy anymore. So I do believe it shows you what you basically need in life to be a happy and performant human being, and that comes with sometimes taking radical decisions, especially in a work context.
So your decision to be a solo entrepreneur in the psychedelic field is within your, let's say, ikigai, which is, let's say, the good thing. I'm curious, next to that, like, what are kind of the challenges that you're experiencing in this entrepreneurial role? Some of the people that listen, they might be entrepreneurs, so they might also be curious, like, how is it actually to be an entrepreneur in the psychedelic space? Like, what are the key challenges that you're experiencing?
Well, one, I'm not saying that my job is more difficult than anyone else's job. Everyone has their challenges. But one, we work in the personal development field. So personal development implies that you need to know that you need to work on something. And a lot of people don't know, or they don't want to know, or they just don't want to go into that alley, or they're just fine the way they are. So that is one. You need to work with people who are self-aware and who want to learn and kind of move the needle or make a few steps. That is one. And then two, they need to see or feel or sense that psychedelics are the way to get there. And of course, there's still a lot of stigma. You referred to it and we talked about it the first hour. Psychedelics are still seen as things that could potentially be highly addictive, where you lose control, and not a lot of people want to lose control, or they're afraid of the reaction of their environment. So that's an objection that I get a lot as well. What will my wife say? What will my husband say? So there's a lot of stigma as well in the world. So that's definitely something that I need to that I struggle with, and that leads to currently demands. Let's say I have a certain number of customers, I have high recurring customers, but I still need to fight for every new customer. That is the case as well, because you one, have the personal development, you two, have the psychedelics and the stigma around it, but three, you have the access. I'm from Belgium, you're originally from Holland. I can drive 30 minutes to Holland, I can go to a smart shop and I can buy a bag of shrooms for 25 euro. So I'm competing against that as well. See what I mean? My price is a little bit shy of 2,000 euro. Of course, it comprises the intake, coaching, 3 days, luxury, medical staff, and the outtake. But some people are like, I'm just going to drive to Holland and buy a bag for 25 grams. And Greg, I'm going to give you a ring and you tell me what to do. you're kind of fighting against that as well. So it's not easy. And I do think that we're a bit ahead of the wave, to be honest. I think there's a lot of clinical work that is being done. MDMA will soon be legalized to treat PTSD in veterans. And that's thanks to the work of Rick Doblin. So in the US, soon MDMA will be legal, psilocybin will be legal, and Europe will follow suit, and we'll have the same in 5 to 10 years. But I'm still fighting against that stigma, you see what I mean? And I'm getting a lot of praise, like being on the podcast, I see as a kind of praise. I get asked on a lot of podcasts, I get asked to speak at a lot of keynote festivals and what have you, but that doesn't necessarily lead to sales. And of course, I may say that I love psychedelics and I love freedom, but if it doesn't pay the bills, then I'll have to make another decision.
Thank you for giving a certain insight in the challenges. And one thing I like about podcasting, it's a bit like when you're on Wikipedia, you know, you always go from one thing to the other thing. So you mentioned podcasting and public speaking. If I remember correctly, at some point I saw you on LinkedIn speaking at the World Economic Forum. Yeah. Did I remember that correctly?
Yes. Yeah.
So can you share a bit? And I also read separately that the World Economic Forum has like specific talks about psychedelics. And World Economic Forum is seen in a way as a bit, you know, traditional businessmen, politicians, but they're apparently also adopting this. So how was your experience to speak at the World Economic Forum?
Yeah, it was a wonderful experience, but of course I was a bit nervous. I see the World Economic Forum is actually a kind of a conglomerate of different kinds of organizations who rally around different topics, right? So who organize events that are in line with certain kind of topics. So, and mine was part of mental health, and within mental health and the use of psychedelics to help mental health, or how could, you know, psychedelics help as well with leadership development. So I had the privilege to speak onto panels. And one of the panels was actually with Rick Doblin. So that's the person who's been presiding MAPS now since 1986, if I'm not mistaken, or 87, I could be wrong. So who's been fighting for the, you know, legal access, you know, of MDMA to treat PTSD in veterans. So, I mean, that's groundbreaking work. So of course, if you're privileged, I'm a little, you know, in Dutch we say a little shrimp compared to that person. So I definitely felt privileged. But then, you know, at the same time, it builds your reputation, or it gives credibility to your brand, to True Nature, but it doesn't necessarily lead to increased sales. And that's what I mean. And I'm not here for the sales, but of course, as an entrepreneur, at the end of the day, you want to make a bit of money, and I have three children as well who need to be brought up. And it was amazing. I felt privileged. I got to know a lot of interesting people, social impact investors. I had a chat with a member of parliament of the Ukraine, who wants to do a similar, you know, who wants to organize retreats as well for people with PTSD in Ukraine or in the Ukraine. So yeah, that fills you with, let's say, pride, and it's wonderful that afterwards I could have another chat with her, and I gave her a download of our program, and maybe she will start the program herself in Ukraine with a specialized team and help people who really need it, who are suffering from PTSD due to the war. So yeah, that is awesome. That is awesome. So yeah, at the same time, I'm Flemish. I come from a province, West Flanders. And we work hard, I mean, not to generalize, and we are pretty humble. In a way, you don't show off. That's how I was born and raised, and that's really part of our DNA here. So I'm not going to be the person who's going to be too vocal about it. And I've had to learn to be vocal about such things as well, because, you know, yeah, I don't know. To me, Davos is, you know, an area where people convene around certain kind of topics, and you educate people, and you form certain kind of relationships or an eco for the betterment of the world. But I had equal fun last year at a keynote festival where there's 100 people only in Ghent, and you know, where the organizer didn't even make ends meet, and I bumped into such amazing people as well, with whom I still maintain very good contact. So yeah, Davos or Ghent, yeah, it doesn't really. I'm very grateful for the opportunities. Yeah, yeah. That's the sense.
I think it must be cool to speak there. It's definitely one of those moments when you feel you're growing in your career, right, or in your life. So you've been a guest at a bunch of podcasts. You've been speaking at the World Economic Forum. If you would be asked to speak at, let's say, TED Global, I think it's in Vancouver or Toronto, what would be, let's say, the title of your TED talk? I mean, you have worked at McKinsey, you know something about psychedelics, but you also have maybe a message for the world. What would be the title?
Oh, that's a very good question. I didn't prepare that one.
I also didn't prepare it. Sometimes it just flows.
Well, first of all, I would be shitting my pants if I were to give a speech at Vancouver TED. But I, what I love is, it would definitely something, it would revolve around how to unlock your untapped potential, or how you can only be your truest self. These kind of things, like you owe it to the world to be your truest self. So I don't have a specific title, but it would be, you know, I love the name of my company, actually, True Nature. I mean, it's maybe logical, maybe, you know, you like Soul Kitchen, I presume, as well. But mm-hmm. to me, it's so in line with my identity. Like, I just hope that everyone can be their true self, like leave baggage from past drama, know what they're here for. And if they don't know and they never know, at least have fun on the journey. And not only have fun on a journey, can spend, you know, that journey with good company, or in good company with people they love and they like. That would be my hope for this world, actually.
But I like it as a potential title. You owe it to the world to be your truest self. It reminds me of this quote that I saw somewhere. What the world needs is people that have come alive. And then you see this man on the skateboard. And in the Soul Kitchen, I always ask people like what their recipe for life is, because in the podcast people can find a recipe. So what would be your recipe for life?
Oh, that's again a very good question, because unfortunately I'm a bit of a melancholic, so I was born with a certain kind of gravitas and you know, and let's say heaviness around me as well, so sometimes it's difficult for me to see the beauty in life. Sometimes I really need to make an effort, but I think a recipe for life, one is, I mean, there's only love. You know whether we like it or not, like being around people who inspire you and who praise you, who love you, and you doing the same for them, I think is the most beautiful thing. I mean, I remember, it's like, unfortunately, growing older, you give a lot of value to money for some kind of reason, right? You make career, and with the career, there's elevated salaries, and then you kind of identify success with the money that is given to you, and then the money that is given to you is then spent on a house, maybe on a second house, a second car. Maybe you want to have a nice television, and with the television come 3D goggles, and you buy the 3D goggles, and then you buy a holder for the 3D goggles, and then you get I don't know what, a housekeeper to clean the 3D goggles. And you know, the most beautiful time I had basically was at university, and I didn't have much money. I had 40 or 50 euros a week. I remember me eating Aiki noodles as well, almost on a daily basis. But the nice thing was that you had a kind of purpose. You had your curriculum, and it was kind of fixed, so you knew when to go to what class when. I made friends for life there as well. I met my then girlfriend, now wife, there as well. So you know, that's, you know, I'd say the recipe for a happy life. You know, give love and be able to receive love, and have fun, and that should be a non-negotiable. If you're not having fun, you're not doing something right. And don't adhere too much value to money. You can do with a lot less. And me, for instance, being on this podcast is worth more than money, because in a way you trust me with maybe the little knowledge that I have. And in a way, if one person is inspired, or even without my help gets a bit further in life, I'd be blessed. See what I mean? Like, if it only were one person, I'd be more than happy.
So there's only love. Give and receive love, and don't attach too much value to money. What is always fascinating me about money is that in the history of humanity, it has been invented to make exchanges simple, right? So it's a way to make exchange more efficient, but then it became a goal in itself. I think that's funny of us as humans. But anyway, I like that, the recipe for love. And related to that, is there anything? You don't have to, but I give you the opportunity. Is there anything you want to share about your own journey in, let's say, love or sexuality, or is that for the next podcast?
Oh, yeah, we can definitely have another podcast. But, you know, I've been quite open about this on LinkedIn as well, that I identify as a bisexual human being. So I'm attracted to both men and women. And my wife knew, and some of my closest friends knew as well, but not everyone. And I've, you know, thanks to psychedelics, actually, I've just told everyone about my bisexuality. And it doesn't necessarily mean that there's bisexual behavior, but at least coming out and saying that this is a case for me has been a ballsy decision, and the pun was not intended. And I want to be an example. See what I mean? And that not from an arrogant point of view, but I once read a study that 14%, again 14% of human beings are attracted to the same gender. Yet only 1.3, if I'm not mistaken, identify as bisexuals. So in a way, there's a giant chasm between, let's say, what people feel and then identify with as well. And I see a lot of men, that's at least what I now see from opening up and getting to know other bisexual and gay men, who have fought so long against this, and that has permeated into their lives as well. Their health was suffering from it. Their relationships were suffering from it. So there's so much actually hurt that we don't see. So if I can be an example, you know, and tell people that I'm a bisexual man and that it's okay to be bisexual, then I presume that, again, if it's only that one person, that, you know, that person's health will benefit from that, their relationships will be better. And that's at least what I hope that I can do for humanity as well, be a kind of example or a role model, even if it's only for one person. And that's definitely thanks to psychedelics. You know, you don't want to hold up any appearances or keep up any appearances anymore. You just want to be you. Like, I just want to be me. And I think it's ecological. I'm not hurting anyone. So I'm claiming me. Me belongs to me. And I'm proud of myself. So, and I think everyone should be proud of themselves.
Yeah, I think that's a beautiful example related to your TED talk, "You Owe to the World to Be Your Truest Self," by showing that. Do you also attract clients that are maybe struggling with this topic because you share about it, or not necessarily your area of focus?
Not professionally, privately, yes. I had burnout and I had depression as well. I'm a lucky human being because I suffered from so many things, actually, that I have a whole area of things that I can talk about and I can help people with. And for instance, for burnout, I do see the interests. So there's quite a lot of people who reach out to me who want to talk about burnout. And this doesn't necessarily translate into business. So I've had last year as well two roundtables about burnout. And I had people who were suffering from burnout or getting out of a burnout or maybe being on the brink of a burnout as well. And I see this my kind of, let's say, mandate to share knowledge on, for instance, burnout, on bisexuality. I've come from a toxic family of origin as well. Like, my dad and my mom used to fight a lot. I developed post-traumatic stress, actually, because of that toxic relationship, and that came out after the burnout. So I can talk about post-traumatic stress due to toxic family situation. So there's a lot that I experienced that I can help people with. And I'm happy to keep on doing that without having to be necessarily paid for it. But then, yeah, of course, at a certain kind of moment, if your time completely were to go to this, then my kids wouldn't have any sandwiches anymore.
Yeah, but I think sometimes when you've gone through a personal journey, it's also exciting to share about it. I've been alcohol free now for nearly 2 years, so if someone wants to talk about it, I'm happy to talk about it. But then if you do it too often, then suddenly it's work, right? So it's about finding a balance. Yeah. Well, you already shared a lot of wisdom. If people are still listening and they're curious to learn a bit more, can you share a few articles or videos or resources that have inspired you related to psychedelics? I mean, you shared them with me, but maybe you can give a brief summary for the listener.
Yeah, definitely. I love what Michael Pollan did on Netflix with How to Change Your Mind. There's four episodes, and one is on, if I'm not mistaken, MDMA. There's another one on mescaline for peyote. There's one on mushrooms as well, and one on LSD. So those are low threshold series that you could look into. You have fantastic fungi or fungi. You have magic medicine as well. So those are very good films and series about psychedelics. Michael Pollan wrote a book, Your Mind on Plants, as well, which is really good. It goes a bit broader, but it talks about caffeine, for instance. So it's nice to see the relationships that you and human beings have with plants, actually, and how long they've existed. So those are series and books that I can recommend. And there's you have the psychedelic spotlight that you can find on LinkedIn as well, that brings a lot of nuggets on psychedelics. You can just go to ChatGPT as well and ask which articles that could be of interest to you, or which scientific studies, because there's so many scientific studies as well, and you can ask ChatGPT the 10 most important scientific studies on psychedelics, and you will find all of the references that you need. It's such a broad topic, basically, and there's so much out there. Gaia TV is pretty cool too, a bit spiritual, esoteric, but there's quite a bit of science as well. So Gaia TV is interesting, and you can find whole episodes on all kinds of mind altering substances and the history. But you can find information on how to channel archangels as well, which is a little bit less interesting to me, but
Well, that's a rich list of resources we also added to the show notes. Yeah. Sometimes I finish an episode with asking, is there anything else you want to say? But since we both worked at McKinsey, I now remember from working there that at the end of the meeting, you always kind of ask people, what is your key insight? And what is your next step? So I kind of want to ask these two questions as a last two.
My main insights with regards to this podcast, or just in
I assume you have some new insight, every conversation. So related to, let's say, our interaction, and then the next step for yourself, maybe based on that insight.
Maybe a tip is I use a lot of 80-20 in whatever I do, and the same holds true with finding your purpose. I think it's nice to find your purpose. In my case, for instance, as well, working with psychedelics to unlock potential or help human beings to be their truest selves. At the same time, I think that people need to be careful as well, not to reverse engineer. See what I mean? With reverse engineering, I mean, I now found it, so I'm going to build a life around psychedelics. I think you need to, for me, it's helping people become their truest selves, right? And psychedelics is one mean. And I still do different kinds of jobs as well. Like I do breath work, I'm an executive coach. So I'm not gonna shove psychedelics through the throats of people either. But I mean, think about the intention and not about a tool. I think that's an important one. And don't reverse engineer your life. That is one. What I'm going to do when this airs, I'm going to broadcast it on all of my social media channels.
amazing. Well, thank you, Greg. I truly enjoyed this episode. What I learned from it is that there's a wide variety of psychedelics and a wide variety of reasons why you can do it. And setting is still important. So thank you for your time, and thanks everyone for listening. And I hope to see you at the next episode.
Thank you so much, Jesper. Bye-bye. Take care.